You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWalkUp, flexible loans built for small businesses. Today, we are in Trento.
Where are we today, Lionel?
We're in Trento, Richard. Second rest day of our Giro. The finish is in sight now, isn't it? In a week's time, well, at the end of the week, we'll be in Milan, virtual Milan. And this is the furthest... Well, if I get through today, let's not count our chickens. If I get through today, this will be the deepest I've gone into the Giro since we started covering it on the ground, because traditionally I've done the first 2 weeks and then one of you drops me at the airport on the second rest day and I watch the final week at home on the television.
We're in uncharted territory here, aren't we, Lionel? How will you cope? Will we find out whether you're a man of the 3 weeks in Italy?
I think we already know that.
You only have to consult previous year's podcast, Richard, and assess Lionel's mental state on the last stage.
Well, no, I get a bit demob happy and start saying all the things that I've been thinking for 10 days.
yeah, I do. I remember a couple of podcasts like that. Lionel Unleashed.
Yeah.
Before he's set off home.
I'm not a Grand Tour rider. I struggle with the endurance.
The evidence of that was in the podcast a couple of days ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When we heard the reports of your demise were not exaggerated.
They weren't.
You had actually abandoned our Giro, but you're getting back on in Mallorca Challenge style. What have we got coming up in today's episode, Lionel?
Well, today is the episode is called Team Hamburger, because we're going to be looking back at the 1984 and 1985 editions of the Giro d'Italia. Do they like hamburgers in Italy, Daniel?
You occasionally will find a hamburger. Yes. I feel this is a very barbed question.
Well, I think the fact that the American team, when they arrived in 85, were called Team Hamburger tells you that to Italians, hamburgers were seen as a very American product.
But we'll be looking back at the stage win by Andy Hampston in 1985. It was only a very short one, 57 or 58 kilometres.
58.
And we'll hear all about that. And we'll also hear about the Linea Gianni Motta team, or Gianni Motta Linea team, depending on which source you read. Well, on the jersey, the logos were about the same size. But they rode in a sort of stars and stripes type jersey. They were an American team, and they had a female team manager, Robin Morton. And Orla Shenoui spoke to Robin Morton for an episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminam, 18 months or so ago, about her experiences working on that Giro. And we'll play a little bit of that in the final part of today's podcast. So an American-themed episode today, Richard. Richard, and part one of your interview with Andy Hampston, part two will come tomorrow when we focus on the 1988 Giro that he actually won.
Yeah, I was going to say it's an Andy Hampston double. We've covered quite a lot of Australians at the Giro, Brits at the Giro, Italians at the Giro, and we're turning our attention to Americans at the Giro. But we're in Trento enjoying our rest day. What can you tell us about where we are, Daniel?
Well, we had a lovely rest day in Trento a couple of years ago, didn't we, Buff? I remember you resurrected your running career. I remember your majestic, imperious silhouette disappearing over the brow of a hill and disappearing into the vineyards.
Did the vineyards ever recover from that?
I'm not sure. No, not sure.
All the grapes jumped off the vines as you went past.
We were at, and I will mention the name of where we stayed because it was fantastic, Agritur Casteller. We had a lovely couple of aperitifs, didn't we? The wine made on the property, served by, I've just looked it up and I remember him now, Marco, the young son of the family that runs that winery. So, thought it would have been nice to return there.
Just on the rest day tradition that we've established in the last, two or three years, we normally do a press conference episode of the podcast, don't we, where we take questions from listeners. We've not done that during our Giro, but perhaps we'll do that in a couple of weeks after our Giro finishes. We'll invite questions from all you listeners out there about professional cycling, and we'll sit down and answer some of them. Why not? Well, before the racing resumes, we'll do one of those type of episodes.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWalkUp, flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, iWalkUp, for their support. We've been talking the last few days about the Sibyls. iWalkUp have been accredited by the British Business Bank to be part of the Sibyls loan scheme for small businesses. I was looking at the iWalkUp COVID hub on their website. Actually, there's lots of interesting stuff on there, including an article, Running a Business Post-Lockdown, Tips from Countries Emerging from Isolation. And there's a little story there about a new e-commerce initiative in Italy called Daya, which is a word we hear a lot at the Giro, isn't it? As riders are encouraged not to Daya, but to go, to what's the, kind of come on, isn't it, Daniel?
Yes. You do hear it a lot, yeah.
Yeah, Daya is an e-commerce platform set up by small business owners in Rome. It's a kind of set up to rival some of the bigger e-commerce platforms, but it's small independent traders. And it's apparently one good example of a solution to for countries coming out of lockdown and starting to function as businesses again. So go to iwalkUp.co.uk. To see what they have there if you run a small business.
What a relief. What a relief that is, Rich, because I thought when they were shouting Daya at me, they were commenting on my cycling technique.
I'm a record. I remember.
I think that's the problem with getting older and older riders, that at one moment they can't they stop to want the suffering. They don't want the suffering anymore. But it actually keeps the same. You know, if you're suffering, you're suffering. There are suffering like yesterday was a really hard stage, but that's nice suffering. Eh? You're full gas racing, and you know you're like fighting with the boys. But if you're suffering in a mountain stage in a group battle, that's suffering. Yeah. You don't have different degrees of suffering if you suffer in a gruppetto. But and once you over that, you don't want to suffer like that anymore, you're done racing. And that's what a lot of older guys got, eh? After 10 years suffering, they say, I don't want to suffer like this anymore. But as long as you can forget about it and you get over it, then you can keep racing, I think, till you're 40, 45. The limit is for everybody is somewhere else. And I think my limit is pretty low. But if I see like we have one rider on the team, Tom Castellanes, last year, he came into the bus after a stage of 240 kilometers and he was crying and he was in this, yeah, what you call the twilight zone of suffering, and I was like, wow, he's a hero, man. Yeah, that's incredible how much he can suffer, and he's not waking up tomorrow, but the next day he was laughing again.
Well, chaps, we've mentioned hamburgers already, and we're going to mention them more in this episode. But Bram Tankink, that was, of course, the rider who used to speak to cows, or was convinced that the cows at the side of the road at bike races were, was it reincarnated cyclists or reincarnated fans? No, reincarnated cyclists. He was quite convinced.
Yeah, reincarnated cyclists. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And that was a conversation with Bram on a rest day a couple of years ago for an episode that we called an episode of Kilometre Zero that we called the Sufferfest, about the ordeal that riders go through when they're suffering in the mountains, how they get through the mountains in the Giro specifically, and and the sort of mental tricks that they employ. And it was one of the episodes I've most enjoyed making. And that was a sort of typical conversation you have on a rest day if you're very lucky with a sort of experienced rider who has been there, seen it all, done it all in professional cycling. And you always feel that on a rest day, or what can happen on a rest day, is that the body is relaxed, the mind is relaxed, and riders tend to get become quite sort of reflective and wistful. And that was certainly one of those occasions. And Bram has a fantastic voice, and was a really colourful character in the professional peloton, retired a couple of years ago, and we miss him.
While we're talking about rest day traditions, another rest day tradition is waiting for Daniel. I remember you flying in from somewhere on a rest day, Daniel, and you came through and realized you'd left, I think, your passport in the pocket. What had you left, your passport or your wallet? I think your wallet you'd left on the plane, and you had to go all the way back through and then go and collect your wallet from the plane before it took off and flew back to wherever it had come from. Do you not remember that?
No, I don't remember that.
And I stood and waited, and then I'd forgot. I hadn't then paid any more money on the car park ticket.
It's a long time since I flew in on a rest day. I'm just trying to think when it would have been. It would have been about 4 or 5 years ago, I think.
It would have been after the Israel start, perhaps, because I think that clashed with Tour de Yorkshire. Is that correct?
It wouldn't have been, because I was already in Sicily. Maybe the year before, 2016 in Tuscany. Boof.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the day, the Bram Tankink day, I don't know if it was your interview with him that caused you to be very late picking me up at Bergamo Airport.
Richard, I was covering the Giro d'Italia.
Very late. And I just remember you arriving in the Maserati and opening the doors and just loads of stuff falling out and having, you know, headphones and everything. Then we drove up into the hills, didn't we, to the what was then the Cannondale team hotel.
No, I chauffeured you into the hills. You demanded that I take you to a team hotel, which I dutifully did.
Yeah, and we sat down with Mike Woods.
You sat down with Mike Woods and I waited in the car.
like a teenager with a bottle of what's that drink you like? Rivella?
Like a chauffeur. Anyway, can we get on to the episode, please? I don't like the way this is going today.
There are all kinds of links. So you mentioned hamburgers, and that was essentially an American team by then. And we're talking about, well, mainly about or to one of the American pioneers, I suppose. Greg LeMond gets all the attention as a three-time Tour de France winner, but the other American who really shone in the 1980s, especially on the climbs, was Andy Hampston. And, you know, there's an argument that Andy Hampston is the great kind of forgotten champion of American cycling, really. He's still the only American ever to win the Giro d'Italia, which he did in 1988, in pretty extraordinary circumstances, and we'll hear all about that story tomorrow. But today we're focusing on the 85 race, where he won a stage in the final week. An unusual stage, as you say, Lionel. It was a very short stage. But just briefly on Andy Hampston, he was always very boyish and fresh-faced. He still is boyish and fresh-faced in his late 50s. But Andy Hampston grew up in North Dakota. His parents were English teachers at the university there, an hour from Fargo. But they were very outdoorsy, and he became a cyclist. He spent a summer at the age of 15 in Cambridgeshire, where he rode some time trials. And then as a professional, he established himself as one of the great climbers. He won at Alpe d'Huez in the Tour de France in 1992. He won the Tour of Switzerland twice, the Tour de Romandie once. Four times he was top 10 at the Tour de France, four times top 10 at the Giro, never rode the Vuelta. We'll hear from Hampston about the circumstances leading up to the 1985 Giro, the fact that he joined the 7-Eleven team mid-season in order to ride it, and he rode it on the rally of his old team, Levi Rally, with his teammates all on Murray bikes. These days, Hampston spends part of the year in Italy, in Tuscany, where he runs bike tours. But his experiences of Italy actually predated that 1985 Giro, as he told me when we spoke recently.
I mean, it was love at first sight, because I raced there a lot as an amateur. I wished I was able to join an amateur team and not just race there with the national team. You know, I was afraid of the things I didn't know. I mean, I guess I should have pointed out, and I think you maybe in previous conversations we talked about in 85 when we were all amateurs, I'm sorry, all neo-pros on 7-Eleven, other than Jonathan Boyer. We were given a lot of grief, which might have been good-natured, but I didn't, my Italian was very poor and I didn't understand it well enough. So we had a lot of, oh, let's call them cowboy situations where Italian pros, maybe it's a loving tradition to pick on the rookies. We didn't look at it that way. So there were a lot of crashes, and our understanding were they were blaming the American rookies on the crashes. Maybe that's just tradition to blame rookies for crashes. But we were very good bike handlers. Maybe we were more aggressive than they were in the corners from all our criterium racing. But we got into a lot of short, obscene shouting matches with Italians over who was to blame for the crashes.
A lot of hand gestures, I imagine.
Yes, we learned them quickly.
Ecco che Austin alza le braccia con un netto anticipo, alza le braccia nel segno del trionfo 200 metri prima del traguardo. Austin ha vinto, seconda vittoria degli americani in questo Giro d'Italia, trionfo dobbiamo dire per la formazione statunitense. Allora Austin, mentre ecco le carreta che sta per essere raggiunto da Acevedo, ecco il ritardo.
When I spoke to you about it before, you described it as your favorite ever victory, your stage win in 85. Would you stand by that?
Oh yeah, the first one, the first really big one.
The astonishing thing about that was you were racing domestically, weren't you, and got a very late call up to the team. How did that come about?
I guess it was typical for our little cycling country back then, because we had so few professional riders. But I was with my Levi's Raleigh team, which was a very good team. We were number two behind 7-Eleven. And our first big races of the year was the Tour of Texas. There was a training camp with the national team that I was on. And most, if you're on the national team or not, all teams went to Texas for just about the whole month of March. And there'd be races every weekend and some training races during the week that the Cycling Federation would put on. So 7-Eleven, who, you know, took out a professional license, which wasn't that difficult compared to an amateur license. They just come back from their spring campaign doing the Tour of Sicily and racing in Italy, where Ron Kiefel won the L'Aquila trophy. So while they were there, they found Hoonved. The Emilio Dell'Olio was the boss of Hoonved, so he would co-sponsor the 7-Eleven team to do the Giro, which, as I understand, was the entry fee was pretty much the hotel bill, and that was $50,000. So he was putting up $50,000 or $100,000 and having the team come back. But now they really needed a climber or a couple of climbers. You know, they needed some help in the mountains or just to round out their team. And I think it was a 10-man team. It might have only been 9. So they contacted me, but I had been in negotiation with them the previous winter about joining the team. Since they were turning pro, they wanted me on the team already, but they weren't sure if it would work out or not. So they didn't hire me for the whole year, but they were eager to hire me for 1 month to do the Giro.
When did you sort of know that you were probably riding the Giro?
Well, I decided as soon as they asked me, which was there was a hill climb prologue and I hadn't seen anyone. They'd flown in just before it somewhere around Austin. And I think Davis rode up to me and told me about their successes, which I'd heard some of. But they said, oh, you know, we want you on the team. He asked me right away and I said, yes, I'll have to figure something out with my team. But my manager, Michael Fatko, was very accommodating. You know, he wanted to take the whole team, his team pro also, but he knew there was enough flexibility with our amateur and professional federations to or let anyone turn pro for a short time or ride for a different team for a short period. And that was some good diplomacy worked out with the international, with the UCI, just because I guess we were classified as a developing cycling country and we had more flexibility with our rules.
So how did you prepare for the Giro? I mean, how did you manage to train for it?
I trained a lot, and I did an interesting race. I did the Tour of Baja, Mexico, for Fred Mangoni's Grupo Sportivo Mangoni. I don't know if you're familiar with Fred Mangoni, but he bought the Professional Cycling Federation. He was an Italian immigrant from New York, quite wealthy. He did real estate, or construction, or one of those New York-y things of the 70s and 80s. Mm. And loved cycling. So he had a little team, you know, of young riders that he wanted to be a bigger team. He sponsored very good riders. He sponsored Steve Bauer in the early 80s and some other really good American riders, but always a pretty small team. But I was able to do the Tour of Baja California with them, and I think I was second or something in it. So I was able to do that. I was able to train in the mountains of Colorado quite hard. You know, that would have been probably April. I spent a lot of time in California if the weather was looking bad in Colorado. And there were some one-day races in California that I could do. But compared to the task I was up for, you know, I certainly wasn't racing with pros in stage races in Europe.
I've spoken to you and others about the sort of reception that you got at the Giro, the American team Hamburger. You've also talked about the style of racing, you know, how slow they would go. Was that one of the things that struck you as the Giro got underway?
Yeah, it really did. And I might have told you horror stories of eating our lunches in the first hour and a half because we were so bored, and then realizing, you know, eating all the food in our pockets. And it was good. We had, you know, good Italian panini in our pockets, but we would be so bored from riding. I don't want to exaggerate, but I'll say 25 kilometers an hour average on wide, flat roads for many of the stages. And then we'd realize, well, the feed, you know, it's 200 and some kilometer stage. The feed's at 150 kilometers. It's going to take us 6 hours to get to lunch. So we go back to the car, and I'm sure we gained weight in some of those stages. But the last half hour, that the TV would broadcast things live from 3:30, and the race would finish at 5 or 5:30. And that last hour and a half or two would be so incredibly fast that we'd be terrified. We'd learn. So the next day, we'd try not to eat all our lunch right away and really be ready for things when it happened. But we thought it would be really hard and fast the whole time. And then the strong people would ride away at the end. But it was... there was a lot of boredom involved to get to the interesting parts. Some teams, I remember certainly Moser and Cerrone were there. Hino was the boss of the whole, I think the European sport was, if not globalized, was centralized enough that he was recognized as the boss. But Moser would strut his stuff. I think he was sponsored by Gies Ice Cream then, or one of the ice cream manufacturers. Mm. And he would, once he stopped along the Adriatic coast where a Gies truck was pulled over, raided the truck, took out a box of ice cream, you know, a lot of ice cream bars in it. And it was pretty funny. And he would hand it out to his teammates and hand it out to his friends. He sort of rode... we were spread out all over, going very slow and laughing and leaving a lot of room so he could wander around no-handed wherever he wanted. And he got to the front, and he still had a lot of ice cream bars. Mm-hmm. And he looked around and didn't see any friends, and he just chucked the whole box into the ditch instead of giving it to unworthy people like myself or Bob Roll or anyone who was asking him for one.
And what was the reception like for you guys? I mean, you did well. I mean, before your stage, when Ron Kiefel won a stage, didn't he? But what were the early days like in terms of the reception?
they were good. We knew, you know, it started in the north, in Verona. We actually did a pretty big loop into the Dolomites. I think the fifth stage was 200 and some stage. I mean, I guess you could check this in the first week. Maybe it would be the first weekend. It was atypical. We did Selva Val Gardena as the first mountaintop finish on a dreadfully wet, cold, long day was my... I remember it's my initiation to pro racing, and I really blew in the last climb and didn't do nearly as well as I was hoping to. But racing in the north, I was pretty familiar with it, and so were a lot of my teammates, because as amateurs, we'd race a lot. There was a pensione called Badagusto that the American amateur national team would spend a lot of time in. And we would do the Settimana Bergamasca every year. And the fans there really knew who we were. So it wasn't that we were in a very completely novel surrounding. We didn't have a lot of fans cheering for us, but Davis Finney was fourth or fifth in the first sprint stage. You know, we didn't feel that we were completely over our heads at the beginning because of that result.
And you found as you went into the 3 week race that you got stronger or that you were recovering well and starting to find your climbing legs. What was that like to experience, not sort of going into the unknown and finding that your body was responding pretty well?
Yeah, it took me a long time, Richard, to get to that point. Or maybe more accurately, it took everyone else the same amount of time to slow down, because I you know, on that first mountain stage, I did quite poorly. I was with the first group. I mean, we must have been 40 people in the main group when we hit the last climb. And I'm sure I ended up 40th or 60th or, you know, I really didn't go the direction I wanted to in it. So my morale was quite low, and I was questioning my abilities as the race went south along the Adriatic coast. There were some hard days where I could just sit in. We hit quite a few mountains in Calabria, and the weather was warm. I felt like I was thawing out and able to, you know, be more comfortable sitting in pretty good groups, you know, the lead group in the warm weather. And Mike Neal, the coach, was talking me up as he would, saying, you're doing well, you recuperate well. But I didn't feel that way because I had such a, you know, in a 7 hour stage, I came apart in the last hour. But we came up through Tuscany and then crossed the Apennines from the town of Cecina, which is 30 kilometers away from where I live now, part of the year in Tuscany, and went over, where was it? Somewhere near Modin. You know, we crossed over towards Bologna, over a long stage over hard mountains. And early in the day, maybe in the first or second hour, a group of about 15 or 20 got away. And it had a couple of La Vie Claire riders in it to police things. But there were enough, it got so much time so quickly because they were riding well together that La Vie Claire had to chase from the back over the Apennines, over the, you know, pretty big, not famous, harsh climbs, but pretty hard climbs. And I was able to ride in that group. And towards the end of it, realized, since we were a group of 15 people chasing 10 or 15 stragglers from the breakaway up the road, that I was really going to move up in general classification. And I was able to pull in the group. And that might have been, you know, 2 weeks into the race. So I was recuperating well. And after that point, I was really encouraged and started being a bit more strategic. Instead of just trying to get into whatever move I could, I was thinking more of moving up in general classification because I wanted to be in the top 20 and also trying to save some energy to win a stage.
Stage 20, a really unusual stage, 58 kilometers. Was that a stage that you liked the look of? Did you fancy your chance of that one, or was there
no, not at all. It seemed silly to me, and I forget why, you know, other than someone paid money to have a stage there. I forget the pretext of, it was because Moser you know, the whole race was designed for Moser to win with very few mountains. And the day before, we had a very long stage over two huge passes. But one was early, and we crossed into Switzerland and rode 3 hours in a flat valley in Switzerland and then came over the St. Bernard Pass. I think it was the Grand St. Bernard, but we took the tunnel instead of old road that goes over the top. That would have been harder. And Moser, to add insult to injury, won the mountain sprint in the dark tunnel in his big chain ring. And that day was the last big mountain stage. So I wanted to attack and try to win, but Mike Neal convinced me, there's a big long run out to the finish. You know, you might be able to get away, but there'll be enough fireworks with the GC riders trying to distance each other and catch each other that they'll have their teams ready. And they'll be so rested because the stage had two big mountains with too much of a lull in the middle to really wear people out. So we said, no, put all your eggs into the next day's basket. The short stage, you know, it didn't, as a climber, I liked people to get very, very tired. And then I liked to attack when I thought they were completely done. And I didn't see that happening, but I went, you know, I saved my energy for that day and was able to go for a morning ride on the course. And I didn't really like the climb because, similarly to my tactics, it didn't get harder and harder as the day went on. It was the hardest at the beginning, had a bit of a downhill in it, and then it was a fairly gradual climb with even big ring climbing as we got closer to the finish. But driving back down in the car to get back to lunch to get ready for the stage, Mike convinced me, everyone knows you're in good form. You didn't do anything yesterday. You held back. You need to, you know, surprise everyone and attack early. And he picked a curve, which happened to be right where we were talking, which is about a kilometer outside of the town of St. Vincent, for me to attack in because it was the steepest part of the road. And he said, you know, someone would probably attack earlier. You know, things might be strung out at this point. This would be a good point to do a hard attack and then, you know, see what happens. You'll probably get in a small group and then play your tactics properly after that. And as the day rolled out, it ended up going exactly to that script.
Scott Amstin, l'americano Amstin, scatto di Amstin che è indubbiamente il migliore tra gli statunitensi nei tratti in salita, si è aggiudicato 4 traguardi validi per il Gran Premio della Montagna e questo californiano ora prova.
My team led me out to the base of the climb as teams do, but it was LaBeclaire keeping their leaders in the front and Moser's team and some other climbers, you know, with everyone having most riders, if it was a 57 kilometer stage, they only had 30 kilometers of racing to do and then just a ride to the top. So it was very fast getting to the base. My team did a brilliant job for me. And I remember I wore a skin suit for the race. We're trying to be European pros. In a road stage, you always wear a jersey. And I thought, no, basically it's a crit and you're going to attack at the beginning. We're going to lead you out to the base of the climb and you're just going to go for it, which is funny. It's a little bit similar to when I was an amateur. I went to Europe. Oh, I was still, you know, pretty young, maybe 19 or so, and we did the Settimana Bergamasca all around Bergamo. And the time trial was pretty neat. It was a team time trial that went up to the old town of Bergamo. And it was a gradual climb. I don't know. Let's say it was 5 kilometers long. Well, the team's time would be taken for team classification at 4 kilometers, 1 kilometer from the finish, where it was fairly gradual. And then the individual time would be whoever's fastest from the base. And U.S. amateur team at that time decided to lead. You know, we'd all work together, but I would rest a bit, and then I would take off for that last kilometer. And it worked. I think we won the team time, but I had the fastest individual time, and I had the leader's jersey. So it was interesting to be back in Italy as a professional now, but use our sort of American racing tactics as best we could. So I certainly agreed with the one piece, and I remember being teased at the starting line by other pros. You know, I'd been riding well before that, so people knew I would be trying to win the stage. It was fun to go through with it with our own style and, you know, wear the one piece. And I attacked right when I wanted to, and it worked out well because Roberto Pagnin did an attack coming out of St. Vincent and got caught exactly at the curve, the big wide curve I was doing. And Bob Roll was still strong enough to lead me out. He was keeping me, you know, as the rubber band stretched going after Roberto Pagnin, he kept me in the top 10, and it bunched up exactly when Pagnin was coming back, and Bob was screaming for me, you know, "Where are you, Andy?" It's, "I'm right on your wheel." And it was 10 or so people across the front of the road, and he moved over a little bit, and I squirted between him and the next rider at exactly the moment I wanted to attack, and I had the legs and lungs to get a good gap right away. It was definitely my last chance. You know, I held back against my instincts, waiting for it. I look at it as my favorite victory ever because there were enough moments. You know, I got a good gap. I could see La Jareta, who always won a stage in the Giro in that time period, trying to get across to me in the first couple of kilometers after my attack, and he couldn't. There was a downhill that I was worried about the group working together with, and after that, the road took a turn, so I could look across to what was happening behind me fairly easily, and I saw it was unorganized. But it was, I had the classic psychological battle in my brain over one voice saying, "Go for it, you got him." And the other voice saying, "You can't do this, they're all pros. You know, you're not good enough." Yes, and I had 20 kilometers to deal with those voices and was able to open things up all the way to the finish. So to me, it was extraordinarily rewarding to be able to cross the finish line first as an unknown, but for me to put all those voices to rest.
You mentioned Mike Neal there, and an important figure, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was fantastic. He knew the European system, the tricks and the dealings that needed to be done, but he also knew just how to deal with the racers. And he was a horse trainer. And I think that's how he looked at us, is right. We are just a lot of skittish thoroughbreds that he needed to deal with.
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their generous support of the Cycling Podcast. And if you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. Now, we heard before the break there from Andy Hampson talking about the 85 Giro, and we'll hear a lot more from him in tomorrow's episode talking about the 1988 Giro. But, you probably remember, Lionel, the glory days of Andy Hampson as vividly as I do.
Yeah, he was one of my favourite riders as a kid watching the Tour de France and the 1988 Giro. I mean, again, just to show how different the media coverage of cycling was in Britain back in those days, I remember buying a copy of Winning Bicycle Racing magazine, which had a report of Hampson's 1988 Giro victory in the magazine and on the cover in about sort of mid to late August, probably, you know, so many months after. You know, I'd read about it in Cycling Weekly, but to see it, sort of a lot of colour photographs and a different account and an interview with Hampson so many months after, it was, life happened in slow motion in those days. I'm not sure how we'd all cope if it was like that today. But the intriguing thing about that 1985 story was, it just makes me think, you know, there's no new ideas under the sun, because again, following the tour, that I knew the story of Stephen Roach wearing a skin suit in the 1985 tour when they had a short stage which went straight up the obisque, and Roach won the stage and was kind of mocked a little bit for wearing a skin suit in a stage race. And then in 2008, I was at the National Championships in Britain when Rob Hales was riding, and I saw him at the start, and he was wearing a skin suit made for him. He was riding for the Halfords Bike Hut team at the time, and I kind of took the mickey a bit and said, well, why are you wearing a skin suit? And he just said quite pointedly, well, it's a time trial, isn't it? And well, he attacked on his own and soloed to the finish and won the national title that year. And then that led to Nicole Cook wearing a skin suit in the Olympic Games road race in Beijing later on that summer. And then when you trace all that back, you know, Andy Hampson did it in 1985. I'm half expecting Daniel to chip in here and say that actually Fausto Coppi wore a skin suit in 51 made of made of wool, or yeah, knitted skin suit. But it's just a nice, charming story, that, really. And as you say, Rich, that little video clip that's on YouTube, it's from the original Rye TV coverage, and we'll put a link in the show notes so people can just see how explosive that attack was. I mean, he came from deep, and he made everybody look like they were standing still. And that's kind of what I remember of the style of racing back then. It wasn't quite the same sort of consistently high pace on mountain stages, was it? There was much more, thrust and counter thrust and a bit more of a tactical stuff at play, wasn't there? And so you did see these kind of extraordinary attacks.
That's how people rode in the mountains. But what's quite interesting or striking listening to that, and we'll hear more of this in tomorrow's episode, is Mike Neal as being the architect of that. And he was a really important figure in that 7-Eleven team, and a fascinating character worth us returning to, I think, in the future.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet interrupting our Giro coverage to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by The Economist. And as a listener to the cycling podcast, you can get 12 issues of The Economist for just £12. Now, The Economist is a smart guide to the forces impacting your world. And, well, the world feels like it's been turned on its head in the last few months, doesn't it? The Economist covers more than just economics and finance. It covers everything from world politics and business to science, technology, the arts, the environment, and even sport. It's been a trusted source of intelligence for over 170 years. Slightly longer than you've been a trusted source of intelligence, Richard, but you've been reading The Economist. What's caught your eye?
I don't think I've been a trusted source of intelligence for any length of time, Lionel, but let's see what we can do about that. It was the headline was COVID-19 might not change cities as much as previous pandemics. Now, a lot of talk at the moment about how cities might become more cycling friendly. Milan is one, London is another one, Paris is another one. Lots of ambitious plans to turn over large areas of the cities to bikes. But on the one hand, depressing article if we want transformed cities, but on the other hand, positive if we want to, you know, get back to some normality and maybe quicker than some of us expect. And this article says that past experience suggests that the pandemic will have only a short-lived impact, briefer than some people now hope, that in the context of transforming cities. As the article says, some people, I think we'd probably include ourselves, hope that it will transform cities. Cycling advocates point to roads that have been closed to cars and argue that they should stay that way. Joel Kotkin, an urbanist at Chapman University in California, believes the coronavirus will speed the end of the megacity era. And the Economist article suggests, and it goes back through history of plagues, cholera, tuberculosis, and their effects on cities over the years and over the centuries. A lot of those previous pandemics forced change because people believed they would return or never leave. By contrast, many people hope that coronavirus will be defeated fairly quickly. In the first country it attacked, some urban adaptations have already been undone. In China, many apartment blocks acquired shelves where delivery drivers could leave food and other goods. Almost as soon as the lockdowns lifted, they were taken down. So if we're wanting radical transformation of our cities and for cities to be redesigned for bikes, perhaps we shouldn't be too optimistic.
Well, that's one of the things about The Economist's coverage of many subjects I've found. They do give it to you straight, the good and the bad, and sometimes you end up reading things that, well, they don't necessarily chime with your worldview in a way.
No, absolutely. What I took from it was actually it'll take more than coronavirus. It'll take a real political will and, you know, kind of public demand for change to happen rather than just coronavirus on its own.
Interesting. Well, if anyone out there wants to get 12 print issues of The Economist delivered to their door for £12, plus The Economist's fantastic digital offering, including full access to economist.com, then all you need to do is text the code CP12. That's CP12 to 78070. That's CP and the number 12 to 78070. And if you miss that, we'll put that code in our show notes.
When we think about Americans at the Giro, we tend to talk about the 85 Giro and that first appearance for 7-Eleven. But in fact, the previous year, as you mentioned earlier, Lionel, there was quite an American influence through a team managed by a female, Robin Morton. And that's quite a story around that team. The team was sponsored by Gianni Motta, who was also the DS in effect, and Robin Morton was the manager. But that was a Giro that was dominated by Francesco Moser, wasn't it? And in the midst of that, of what at the time was a very Italian affair, there was this American woman driving a team car and being part of the entourage, which at the time was pretty controversial.
Yeah, well, as we'll hear, they basically, the other team directors had a vote to decide whether or not Robin Morton should be allowed to travel in the team car and be part of the team's management. It's a fascinating story, and Orla spoke to her a couple of years ago, and we'll play a little bit of that interview. But they were a small team, weren't they? They were the minnows in the Giro, but they were supported by Gianni Motta, 1966 Giro champion, who was basically the sports director sportif. And they were a predominantly American team. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of them finished the Giro, although, you know, it was a struggle for some of them. Greg Saunders finished last overall. Tom Ruttage was a couple of places ahead, and Rudy Weber was a few places ahead of that. So they were in the gruppetto every day. John Eustace, of course, was part of ESPN and ABC's cycling coverage on TV, covering the Tour de France for a number of years, a long time, in fact, sort of early 90s through to about the mid-2000s. They had their great jersey, the Stars and Stripes that I talked about earlier. And early in the race, Carl Maxson almost took the pink jersey, or he's certainly the virtual race leader. He was a solo escapee, and he got 20 plus minutes up the road. And had Laurent Fignon not crashed, prompting Moser and Cerrone's teams to turn the screw and forcing the bunch to speed up, Maxson might well have stayed away and won the stage. If you want to read more about not just this Giro, but lots of editions of the Giro d'Italia, it's worth checking out a website, bikeraceinfo.com, run by Bill and Carol McGann. Has detailed reports of most of the races taken from their books, The Story of the Giro d'Italia, which is available in print and online. And a really interesting detail in a lot of the accounts of, well, they're year-by-year accounts of the Giro. But quite an amazing story. I mean, it's surely not going to be long before a men's World Tour team has a woman at the helm. It will happen at some point, surely. But when? Well, I don't know.
Gianni Motta was always a bit of a pioneer chap. So, I mean, he won the Giro in 1966. And funnily enough, looked a bit like Bobby Moore. Unusual looking Italian.
I don't like where this is heading.
Yeah, I don't like reminding Lionel that England won the World Cup in 1966, when just a few weeks after Gianni Motta won the Giro. But, you know, both sort of golden boys, blonde, curly hair, good looking chaps. And Gianni Motta was certainly the golden boy of Italian cycling at that time. I think he was 23 when he won that Giro. So he was young, had the world at his feet. But a strange thing happened the following spring at the Giro. So he was really struggling, and there was a doctor called Gianni Aldo De Donato, who was a mysterious character. Well, he was a surgeon and biochemist, and he also was a general practitioner. And one day he was examining one of his patients, and he noticed a sort of strange, what he describes as a strange agitation in this patient. And he was interrogating the patient, and he found out that the cause of this gentleman's ills was that he couldn't figure out why Gianni Motta wasn't going better in the mountains in the Giro. At which point this doctor, Gianni Aldo De Donato, who also, by the way, had been credited with inventing the world's first antiviral medicine, but since gone back to general practice, he wrote to Gianni Motta. Gianni Motta politely wrote back to him, and a sort of pen pal kind of arrangement sprung up between them, and eventually De Donato started sending him pills in the post, as you do. Pills under the commercial name Lily. They contained a catalyst of 13 biochemical reactions which take place in the muscle, or so he claimed. And De Donato increasingly started to sound like a bit of a crackpot shaman. But Motta was completely under his spell. And De Donato started giving interviews, bizarre interviews, sort of Eric Cantona-esque interviews. He gave one in which he said, "Gianni Motta is a squirrel. Mother Nature has been good to Gianni. Put a squirrel and a mole at the bottom of a tree, and the squirrel will climb up while the mole will stay down below. He's a squirrel. He's been lucky, as Gianni. He'll succeed in everything he does in life." And Motta,
and we've
started...
already heard from a rabbit in this episode, Le Petit Lapin, as Bernardino called Andy Hamston.
There you go. But alas, Gianni Motta, despite being put on a strict regimen of meat milkshakes, I can't imagine what they were like, adopting some very strange training protocols, and also racing protocols. He started attacking, you know, from the gun in races, doing things that were just completely bizarre. It didn't really succeed, and there was increasing skepticism about this chap De Donato's credentials, despite the fact that he was sometimes described as a NASA cosmonaut, because the press didn't really know what he was. They just knew that he had a fantastically colourful past, and they knew he was doing something slightly exotic with Motta, but it didn't really work. And it took Gianni Motta a while to get his mojo back.
The penny dropped, apparently, when he also advised Gianni Motta to drink cappuccino after 11 o'clock in the morning, I believe. That was just a step too far. Meat milkshakes were fine, but that was a step too far.
I like the sound of a meat milkshake. I mean, the 7-Eleven team, they probably, if meat milkshakes had been available during the 1985 Giro, I'm sure the 7-Eleven riders would have loved them.
Let's hear a little clip from Orla's interview with Robin Morton. It was in the January 2018 episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina. If you want to go back and listen to the full interview, you'll find it. It's there, and it's fascinating because she is a really interesting character. So here's a little bit from that interview now.
I really went into it having no prior experience managing a team, especially a men's team. I didn't come at it from a lot of other directors where they were previously athletes or had been involved in the sport, maybe even in some coaching capacity. So for me, it was just a little bit kind of going into it not with my eyes wide open, the other way around. And I wasn't totally prepared for some of the things that would happen, both financially and, you know, in different ways. I mean, it was a great experience. It was a learning experience, and I wouldn't change it for anything, but definitely I was not prepared. I went from organizing this team in the U.S. and doing domestic racing to going to Italy and racing the Giro. And so I was the only woman at that point, you know, in an entourage of a couple hundred men. They didn't even have women's soigneurs yet. 7-Eleven was the first one to have that, and they hadn't even kind of embarked on their European campaign. So when I got to Italy and, you know, found myself in my late 20s in the middle of this sea of masculinity, they actually, you know, we got there and the directors had to vote as to whether or not I was even allowed to be in the caravan. I don't know what I would have done if they said no. You know, I wasn't prepared to go home, but they actually had to take a vote in the manager's meeting as to whether or not I could even be there. I don't even know if it was a UCI regulation, but I think it was something that they had never experienced before. And I cannot actually recall. I don't know if it was the president of the jury of the UCI, if it was Vincenzo Turiani, who at that point was the director of the Giro. But yeah, they had to take a vote, like actually a raise your hand, yes or no, can she be here? If I recall, I think it was unanimous. Gianni Moda probably paid everyone off. No, I'm kidding. But because it was a great PR vehicle for him and for the team to have me there. And then we celebrated with a glass of champagne. So it was very Italian.
What was it like being the only woman at the Giro d'Italia? I've covered it myself a few times. And even now, let's say there are a few cultural differences in Italy, whereby, well, by some standards, it would appear a little bit sexist. But I put a lot of that down to culture. And that's today. Back in the early 80s, it must have been another level.
Well, I will say that, you know, they were the riders and the directors were pretty respectful. At the same time, you know, I was a young woman and it was a whole different experience for them. And it was very old world. I mean, they would not let me sit or eat with the riders. You know, they made me sit at a separate table with the support personnel and I didn't really speak Italian. So for me, that was just like, well, okay, you know, I'm in the car all day. I'm not speaking English. I have to sit here, you know, and the riders wanted me there. So we kind of breached protocol. And that was a big deal because I would eat dinner with the riders at night versus the team personnel and so forth. And, you know, that was kind of scandalous. But yeah, it was a different experience. I can remember at one point, you know, in the morning before the stage start, Rancilio, who was a espresso machine and espresso maker, they had their trailer that came there and all of the team captains would go in there every morning before the start of the stages to kind of just sit around and, you know, shoot the breeze and have an espresso before the start. And so one morning, they had invited me in there and said, well, you know, you're kind of one of the guys now and we want you to come in and sit down and have an espresso with us. So I went in there and it was like Moser and Vincentini and Fignon and, you know, Roger de Vlaminck and all these riders that I was really in awe of. And so we're sitting there and they said, well, you know, now we think you're like one of the guys and we have something that we want to give you. And I'm thinking, okay, this is great. It's going to be like a signed Maglia Rosa or some kind of Giro memorabilia. And they came out with a tray of vegetables in the shape of male genitalia and presented me with, like, you know, eggplants and all kinds of weird things. So, yeah. But they did have a photographer there, so it was totally a setup.
So that was Robin Morton in conversation with Orla Shinoui. And as I say, the full interview is in the January 2018 episode of A Cycling Podcast Femina. There'll be a link to that in the show notes for this episode. That's about all for tonight, the rest day. We're back in the saddle tomorrow, back with Andy Hampston for the story of the 1988 Giro, and in particular the stage over the Gavia in the snow, which has gone down in Giro kind of folklore as one of the epic stages in the history of the race. Can I say epic? Definitely.
Yeah, that counts. That counts. Yeah.
I think we used it yesterday. I think we fell foul of the epic Carabinieri yesterday already. I think I said it.
If that wasn't epic, I don't know what would qualify as epic. That was
definitely. No. I mean, the problem is a sort of run-of-the-mill edition of Gent-Wevelgem has become epic in, you know, these days, isn't it? It's overused, but I think that Gavia stage does definitely qualify.
Here's a quick public announcement. The first batch of Stacey Snyder's Cycling Podcast Giro mugs and cappuccino sets sold out in about 11 minutes. The second and final batch will go on sale on Wednesday at 12:30 US East Coast time. That's 12:30 PM US East Coast time. That's 5:30 PM British Summer time, 6:30 PM Central European time. Proceeds from the sales of the mugs and the cappuccino sets go to the Scuola Ciclismo Ceni. To buy one or more of the mugs or cappuccino sets, go to www.etsy.com/shop/Snyder Ceramics. That's SnyderCeramics. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.